to Day On Against the Grain. What do family members of unsolved murder victims have to contend with? How are they viewed and treated by law enforcement, and what resources can they draw upon? I'm CS. An eye-opening report examines the lived experiences of mostly African-American family members of homicide victims in Oakland. We'll re-present a conversation with the report's author, Roxana Althols, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. If a loved one of yours were murdered, how would you feel? The grief might be overwhelming, but what if you also found the police biased and disrespectful, the detectives dismissive, the investigation ineffective, and support services inadequate? Well, many people interviewed for a recent study, a study of mostly African-American family members of unsolved murder victims in Oakland, said they suffered all of these affronts and abuses. The International Human Rights Law Clinic at UC Berkeley School of Law has issued a report called Living with Impunity: Unsolved Murders in Oakland and the Human Rights Impact on Victims' Family Members. The report's author, Roxana Althols, is a law professor at Berkeley Law and the clinic's co-director. When Roxana Althols joined me recently via Skype, I began by asking how violent, in terms of shootings and homicides, how violent Oakland has been over the last couple decades.
Over the last couple of decades, Oakland has had a higher rate of violence per capita than California or the United States. It has been labeled as one of the most violent cities in the United States. Between 2014 and 2018 alone, there were 416 homicides and 1,233 non-fatal shootings in Oakland. And studies have indicated that much of that violence is retaliatory in nature.
What percentage of the city's homicide victims, let's say in the last decade, have been African American?
So there is incomplete data available, but as far as the Washington Post did a fantastic series of pieces on unsolved murder in the United States. And according to their information, they relied both on FBI statistics or statistics gathered by the FBI and death records. 76% in the last decade of the city's homicide victims were Black.
Your report refers to racial disparities in arrest rates for homicides in Oakland. What can you tell us about those disparities?
Racial disparities exist nationwide. They're particularly worrisome in Oakland. So during the last decade, police made arrests in approximately 40% of Oakland homicides involving Black victims, which means in 60% of those homicides, there was no arrest made. And Oakland police made arrests in about 80% of homicides involving white victims. If we look at the arrest rates in particular neighborhoods, the arrest rates are even lower. So in East and West Oakland neighborhoods, where most of the violence occurs, less than one in three homicides resulted in arrest during the last decade. And that means that part of the legacy of violence in Oakland and the way the police has responded to that violence is a huge backlog of unsolved murder cases. Oakland has not published the exact figure, but as far as we can tell, there's about 2,000 cold homicides on Oakland's books. And that is a comparable backlog. Other cities that have high rates of murder have a comparable large backlog of unsolved murder cases.
How many people did you talk to for this study, and what demographic information about them can you share with us?
For this study, we conducted in-depth interviews of 15 family members of 16 separate murder victims that all occurred in Oakland. And we interviewed 38 key informants about the impacts of homicides. And that included members of law enforcement, academics, journalists, and victim service providers. OPD, Oakland Police Department, refused to participate in the study. We made multiple requests. Only one former detective would sit down with us for an interview. But we did interview victim service providers who work with law enforcement and in law enforcement, so in the district attorney's office. What is unique about this study in comparison to other studies of homicide survivors or the family members of homicide victims is the demographics of the family members that we interviewed. 87% of the family members we interviewed were Black, 13% identified as mixed race or Latino, and 73% were female. And in most other studies that have looked at the impacts of homicide, the interview subjects have mostly been middle-class whites.
You write that each homicide affects an estimated 6 to 10 family members. Now, we're going to get into some detail about your findings, but just in general, what are some of the things that family members of homicide victims experience on an emotional level?
On an emotional level, it's been well documented the disaster that homicide leaves in its wake. The majority of family members experience nightmares, intrusive thoughts, startle reactions, difficulty concentrating. Those are all symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. A study found that 50% of family members of homicide victims show symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. They also commonly experience anxiety, depression, complicated grief, and almost a quarter of family members not only experience the symptoms of PTSD, but actually develop the disorder, and that really interferes with their day-to-day functioning. The emotional reactions are also profound. Family members experience anger and guilt and blame, and children particularly experience quite profound emotional and behavioral consequences. Children can become withdrawn and feel anger and struggle to perform in at school or have other behavioral consequences.
Yeah, and I'm going to guess, Roxana, that when the murder case of your loved one is unsolved, there may be additional emotions and additional suffering added on to the layers that are already there.
That's right. Homicide of a loved one is profoundly painful. And family members who have unsolved cases have to deal with the criminal investigation, with unanswered questions, with media, and potentially, you know, the criminal justice system. And family members have commonly reported that their interactions with prosecutors and police, with social workers and judges, have aggravated their grief and prolonged their healing process. They have to deal with the indifference and the brutality of our criminal justice system. So in my career, the way I've come to think of it, having represented family members for my entire career, is that there's a twin violence that occurs. There's the violence and the brutality of the killing, and then there's the violence and brutality of the impunity. And the violence and brutality of the impunity can really undermine the family members' sense of belonging and citizenship within society. Because family members interpret the fact that the case has not been solved or investigated effectively as a message about the value of the victim in society, about the value of their loved one in society.
That's Roxana Althols. She's a clinical professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law, co-director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic, and we're talking about a report recently issued by the clinic and authored by her. It's entitled Living with Impunity: Unsolved Murders in Oakland and the Human Rights Impact on Victims' Family Members. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. So there are a number of sections in your report, and many of them correspond to kind of phases in family members' interaction with the police or other law enforcement officials. Notification of death. So, family members describe to you, among many other things, their experience with law enforcement at the time of first hearing about the death of their loved one. What did family members tell you about that experience and how it occurred?
Family members described the vast majority not receiving any official notification of their loved one's death. So the way the family members found out that their son or brother had just died was through social media, from friends, or from other families. The police, actually, Oakland Police Department has no protocol for notifying family members of the death of a loved one. There are best practices on how those notifications should take place. Family members should be notified in private by someone who has information that they can share and the opportunity to answer questions. These family members, therefore, their first encounter with the police was not as a source of comfort and respect, but was usually either at the crime scene or with the police asking questions about whether the family member had information regarding the homicide.
Well, let's talk about the crime scene, the interaction of family members with law enforcement at that point. What did family members describe to you about that?
So a handful of family members went to the crime scene where their loved one body was, and described a really horrific scene. You know, I mostly interviewed parents, and the parents were understandably in shock and grief and experiencing high levels of trauma. One of the fathers told me about trying to go to cross the police tape. He wanted to see if that was his son. He needed to see if that was his son laying there. And a police officer told him to back away. And when he pushed forward, the police officer unholstered his weapon and threatened to arrest him. Another mother, again, tried to see her son. She wanted to know what had happened, and she got a reaction that was typical of what the family members described, which was the police officer telling her nonchalantly, "Back away, ma'am, back away, ma'am," knowing that her son was laying on the ground around the corner.
So in other words, in some instances, treated like a bystander?
At best, family members described being treated as a bystander. At worst, they were treated as a threat to the officer's safety. Again, the Oakland Police Department has no protocol for how to attend, how to address the trauma, the emotional needs of the family members at a crime scene.
And then there is the follow-up investigation. I mean, there's much more in this report that people should, that I recommend people read and learn about. But there is then, of course, the investigation that is done or should be done in the wake of the homicide. And family members, of course, want to be in touch with the detectives. They want to hear how the investigation is going. What were their experiences about and in relation to the follow-up investigation, the search for the murder suspect?
So in the initial moments of the investigation, I want to read a quote from a mother who had a typical encounter with Oakland detectives at the hospital shortly after learning that her son was dead. She said, basically, the way the detective was asking me questions was more like he was talking to the person that did it instead of someone's mother. And then the family members described, after those that initial contact, not hearing again from the detectives. Many family members described calling detectives every day, every week, never receiving a phone call back. Oakland Police Department does not have a protocol. Does not have a protocol for death notification, for what to do at the crime scene, and has no protocol for how to handle long-term contact with family members in unsolved murder cases.
What are the emotional consequences of not hearing back from detectives or not being provided with information that the family member needs, or at least a sympathetic ear?
The family members interpreted what they perceived as law enforcement indifference as a message of what the police thought about the victim. So a mother of a 2011 homicide victim put it this way: the police still haven't reached out and given any information because it's like, oh, my son is just another black guy dead. If the police would start solving these cases, they would not be as many killings. Go to Oakland, do your killing, because you're going to get away with it. That's the profound implications of not providing family members with the simple courtesy of returning phone calls and not providing family members with information about the investigation.
What biases do family members feel are being expressed, maybe explicitly or implicitly, by the way that OPD, the way that detectives are talking to them?
Family members spoke a lot about race and described a belief that if the victims were white, the investigation would be handled differently. And one of the most distressing and disturbing aspects of this report was a few family members said that they had heard the term public service murders, which was used to describe how the police viewed the deaths of young black men in Oakland and why the police did not properly investigate those homicides.
And what's a public service murder?
From how it was explained to me, it was this idea that the victim was involved in criminal activity and his life had no value to society, that the homicide was in the service of the public. And that is a fracture, a breach of a social contract. If a homicide happens at the very foundational level, we expect the police to investigate the homicide. And African-American families, not just in Oakland, but all over the country, that social contract has not been upheld by law enforcement.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Roxana Althols joins me. She is an international human rights lawyer and scholar based at UC Berkeley School of Law. And we are talking about a report she authored that's been issued by the International Human Rights Law Clinic that she co-directs. It's called Living with Impunity: Unsolved Murders in Oakland and the Human Rights Impact on Victims' Family Members. The report, your report, refers to disenfranchised grief, saying that many families described the dynamics associated with disenfranchised grief. What is that?
So disenfranchised grief is defined as a loss that is not or cannot be openly acknowledged, publicly mourned, or socially supported. And I use it in the report to describe really the stigma that many family members felt. They felt that their loved one's life could not be openly mourned, that the fact that it had not been investigated and the murder was not solved said something about the value of that victim. And I wanted to just emphasize the resilience and the efforts of the family members to fight against that stigma. So family members try to counteract the pernicious effects of bias and racism in a number of ways. A mother explained, for example, that I'll call the detectives. I'm going to call them. I'm going to continue to go to the police station because I'm not going to have my son become a statistic where he is just gunned down in the street like that and they sweep it up under the rug. The victim services that we have in Oakland for homicide survivors, for the family members of homicide victims, are really the projects of mothers whose sons were killed and saw the dearth of support and decided to do something about it. So one person, for example, is Marilyn Harris Washington. She started the Gaddafi Foundation after her son was murdered. She's attended more than 3,000 funerals. Lorraine Taylor, her twin boys were murdered in 2000. She has also started an organization to support the family members of homicide victims in Oakland.
Victim services programs. So you've spoken a little bit about the origins of these programs. What does Oakland's program look like in terms of, you know, the kinds of assistance and support that, I guess, at least theoretically or by law, ought to be provided or offered to family members of homicide victims?
So I'd like to answer that question by just first saying that every state in the country has a program to compensate and assist crime victims. California, in fact, was the first state in the country to start a victim compensation program. And the United States allocates $2 to $3 billion a year to provide services to crime victims, and California allocates hundreds of millions of dollars. That support is not being used for the benefit of these family members. There is a way that California law, and this is true of many states in the country, divides victims into undeserving victims and deserving victims. So although by law, crime victims have the right to financial assistance to help their recovery from being victimized, California law does not provide financial assistance to certain individuals with criminal records. They allow the police to determine whether a victim was, or family member, excuse me, was involved in the crime or did not adequately cooperate with the police. So the police in Oakland, according to the family members, have used their ability to block access to financial assistance as leverage over the family members to force them or to get cooperation from them on the murder investigation, which I think is not only immoral but ineffective. So many family members felt doubly victimized by the situation.
But some listeners might think, well, what's wrong with cooperating with law enforcement? I mean, if the crime needs to be solved, why shouldn't the police use some kind of leverage, in this case, financial assistance or eligibility of financial assistance for assistance to get the family to cooperate with them?
So in financial assistance, I just want to be specific about what we're talking about. We're talking about funds to help bury the child or the victim. We're talking about denying a mother funds to help bury her son. Many of the family members I interviewed, in fact, had conducted their own parallel investigation when they saw that the investigation being conducted by law enforcement wasn't effective. They are profoundly interested in solving the crime. What is difficult is the possibility of reprisal. So family members have very legitimate reasons for being afraid to cooperate with investigations. Alameda County invests about $30,000 a year in witness protection. That is a paltry sum given the rate of violence in Oakland. There should be stronger victim protection measures in order to incentivize cooperation. Access to family, to financial assistance to help with the recovery shouldn't be used as leverage.
Yeah, and what you were saying earlier about the fact that financial assistance wouldn't be granted, isn't being granted, if the homicide victim is considered to be involved with his homicide, that doesn't sound promising, because you were saying earlier that the cops often see the homicide victim as being somehow culpable.
What involved with means is not well defined. And Oakland police, according to some of the interviews I conducted, there was a concern that Oakland police was relying on databases about affiliation with gangs or groups involved in criminal activity that were inaccurate, and using those databases to deny family members access to financial assistance. You know, a father whose son is killed experiences pain. There's no difference in that pain if the father has a conviction or is on parole or probation for a felony. The pain is there. And the purpose of crime victims' services is to help family members with recovery. That should be done in a non-discriminatory fashion. I also say that recently Oakland has been using a program called Ceasefire to reduce violence, and according to city leaders, have been really successful in reducing violence by 50% in the last 6 years, I believe it is. And what Ceasefire is identifying individuals in Oakland who are most likely to be involved in violence or being the victim of violence, and offering them social support, social services, a way to protect themselves and protect their families, a path forward. There's no reason why a similar logic shouldn't be applied to the family members of homicide victims, and we shouldn't provide support, investment into their well-being in a non-discriminatory fashion.
Roxana Althols joins me. She teaches law at UC Berkeley School of Law, co-director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic. We'll take a short break and speak more with her about her report issued by the clinic called Living with Impunity. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Roxana Althols joins me, A-L-T-H-O-L-Z. She's an international human rights lawyer and scholar based at Berkeley Law, and she authored a report recently issued by the clinic that she co-directs there, the International Human Rights Law Clinic. It's called Living with Impunity, Unsolved Murders in Oakland, and the Human Rights Impact on Victims' Family Members. Well, yeah, your focus is human rights. You've been telling me in important detail about a lot of the specifics of what these family members are going through, the kinds of assistance either that they're eligible for but often are denied. From a human rights perspective, what are the concepts we need to understand? What does human rights law require authorities to do in cases of homicide, and also in relation to the loved ones of the homicide victim?
So the most important concept that this report uses from human rights is the concept of impunity. International human rights law regulates the behavior of states. And so by using that concept, we're focused on state action and state inaction. The way we think about violence in this country, unfortunately, we often focus on the behavior of individuals. And what I was interested in examining was, what is the state doing to help family members who experience loss, who are victimized, and what should the state be doing? And I leveraged international human rights to engage in that analysis. International human rights bodies have condemned states for generating impunity. So, for example, in the context of domestic violence, when states have failed to take adequate measures to address patterns of violence, even when that violence is committed by private individuals. And you see that in Oakland. You see a systemic failure to prevent violence, a systemic failure to investigate, and a systemic failure to provide support and assistance to family members without discrimination. And that is arguably a violation of international human rights law. Now, obviously, Oakland is not war-torn Bosnia or Rwanda, but the effects of impunity that have been identified by international bodies can help us understand and address the experiences of family members of murder victims in Oakland. What I was really interested in this report is many scholars have looked at why are murders not being solved? For this report, I was interested in moving past that question and thinking about what it felt like to live in communities where murders are systematically not solved for a particular segment of the population. Like I said at the outset of this interview, 80% of murders are solved if the victim is white. Only 40% of murders are solved if the victim's black in Oakland. So I'm using human rights to deepen understanding of what is the experience of family members in Oakland living with unsolved murders.
According to your report, states under international human rights law have an obligation to ensure that long-term services of rehabilitation are accessible to victims and their families without discrimination. What is meant by rehabilitation here?
Rehabilitation is a perspective from international bodies that when a state is responsible for a violation, the state has a duty to remedy the violation. And that should not include only potentially monetary compensation or a criminal investigation, but it also should include access to legal services, mental health counseling, other rehabilitative services that will help the family members along their path towards recovery.
And are those services, those kinds of services, typically offered or provided to family members of homicide victims in Oakland?
I think you have many victim service providers in Oakland who are committed to that goal, profoundly committed to that goal. Unfortunately, they don't have the resources to attain that aspirational goal. So family members in Oakland, under California law, are provided financial assistance, access to mental health counseling, help with relocation for a maximum of a 2-year period. And obviously the consequences of living with an unsolved murder goes well beyond a 2-year period. It's going to affect the lives of family members for a much longer period than that. There are also caps on how much assistance a family member can be provided. And what I found in the study, what I did was I made a public records request and obtained records from the California Compensation Program, which is the state agency that provides family members with access to financial assistance. And what I found is that a good percentage of family members of homicide victims did obtain financial assistance for funeral expenses. A smaller portion obtained financial assistance for mental health counseling. And despite the rate of violence in Oakland, very few were provided financial assistance for example, relocation. And the type of financial assistance that they're eligible for is very modest. So at a maximum, the state is willing to help a family member of a homicide victim in Oakland relocate with $2,000, which for all of us who live in the Bay Area, we understand that $2,000 is nowhere near the amount that would be needed to really provide family members a chance to start anew somewhere else.
And for what reasons did family members, at least some of the family members you spoke with, want to relocate after the killing, the murder of their loved one?
Some of them were afraid for their lives. One mother told me that her son had some information about who was responsible for the murder and was terrified. Even, I think that murder had happened 5 to 6 years before the interview, was still terrified that her son would suffer reprisals. So there's their security and safety. And other family members, their child had been killed on their doorstep. And they just couldn't take living in the home. Or going to the corner store, their entire community knew that their child had been murdered. And they had other young children and wanted to give their younger children the opportunity to start afresh and not have to live with the stigma and the blame of and the shame of a loved one who had been killed by homicide.
Let's talk about what the family members want in terms of justice. And maybe we can put that in quotes because we'll define that, or you'll help us define that, what it meant, what justice meant for these folks. So you have a loved one being, in many cases, shot and killed. There's obviously intense anger. There's a desire for the police to find who did it. What did family members, if you can generalize, want done, for example, with the perpetrator, and how did they envision justice, a kind of justice that might give them some peace, some measure of peace?
One of the questions we asked the family members is, what does justice look like to you? We wanted to leave it very open-ended. And many family members describe justice as being accountability and punishment. What they were pursuing was a bigger goal. They really didn't want to see another person suffer what they had suffered. They wanted to see accountability because they didn't want to see the perpetrator commit another crime. They didn't want another mother to cry the tears they had cried. Many family members had really a holistic view of justice. And what I mean by that is a view of justice that extended beyond the prosecution of perpetrators. From their perspective, justice, in order for there to be justice, there had to be measures that addressed their needs and provided family members with support and assistance and honored the memory of the victims. Family members had their own ways of keeping the victim present, of honoring who the victim was. And they asked for the government to cooperate in that effort. And what that would look like was very modest requests, like a letter from a city leader on the anniversary of their child's death that recognized the loss for them, communication from the police, a monument that would honor the memory of the many, many victims of violence in Oakland. And I think it's really important to keep in mind the rates of victimization, especially the African-American community. African-Americans, especially Black youth, are at a disproportionate rate of exposure to trauma. Nationwide, homicide is the leading cause of death for African-Americans between the ages of 10 and 34, and Black youth are 7.8 times more likely than whites to experience the homicide of a loved one. On average, in fact, African-Americans experience the homicide of two loved ones in their lifetime. Many of the people I interviewed, one father, for example, his son had been killed, his nephew had been killed, the mother of his son had been killed, and his brother had been killed, all in separate incidences of violence in Oakland, and all the murders had been unsolved.
My guest is Roxana Altholz. She is a clinical professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law and co-director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic. We are talking about a report recently issued by the clinic and authored by Roxana. It's entitled Living with Impunity, Unsolved Murders in Oakland and the Human Rights Impact on Victims' Family Members. We've put a link to that report on our website, againstthegrain.org. So let's talk about some of the recommendations of your report. And you've been referring, for example, to the lack of OPD protocol for this, for example, death notifications or for ways of interacting with family members. On the issue of making victim services more accessible, because as you were saying, a lot of this assistance whether financial or not, is denied for various reasons. How can such services for family members be made more accessible?
So legislation has been introduced in Sacramento to eliminate police discretion in denying access to financial services by people who the police determine were involved in the crime. I think that's a really important measure. I think that California should rethink dividing victims into categories of deserving and undeserving and recognize the victimhood of everyone. I think also it is important for victims to have access to long-term services, long-term mental health counseling. One thing, for example, that victim service providers described to me was a lot of pressure for victims to, or family members, I should say, to agree to mental health counseling in the hours or days after the homicide. At that moment, the family members are living under the fog of grief. And while they may decide not to pursue mental health counseling at that moment, in 6 months, a year, or 2 years, they may be needing that kind of support. So this two-year cap on when victims can seek services, I think, is a huge barrier to access to the kind of support that and assistance that family members need.
So let's say right after a homicide, if the family member is approached, and I think they are typically, with offers of assistance for emotional support, and they decline it, as you said, because perhaps they're still in shock, are they then approached later on or periodically or over the long term with requests such as, you know, can we help you? Can we get you into some kind of treatment?
Now, nonprofit organizations are leading those outreach efforts, and they simply don't have the resources to continue to conduct outreach beyond the first year. And so, no, they're not approached. And I think that that is leading to a significant gap and a consequential gap in services for family members.
And what are some of the other recommendations of this report?
The report findings indicate that there's a real need, as we've been discussing, to develop wraparound long-term services. I also just wanted to highlight that this isn't in a way about resources. About 41% of Oakland budget goes to the police. That is more than in many, many cities in this country. And it isn't also, this isn't a problem that the police can train their way out of. What is really needed to address the kinds of issues that the report touches upon are changes to policies, changes to the way family members are notified of the death, what happens at the crime scene, and what happens during the investigation. I also think that there is a need for a needs assessment. A needs assessment that focuses on the experiences of the communities that are most directly disproportionately affected by this problem of unsolved murders. And that means focusing on the communities in East and West Oakland.
And of course, you referred earlier to your concern about assistance for relocation of family members who do not feel safe or secure after the homicide, that those services, that assistance be expanded, right?
I think it is vital that Oakland develop an adequate and effective program to relocate family members of homicide victims who are not necessarily witnesses but feel unsafe in their homes. And the $2,000 statutory cap for relocation expenses is insufficient to help families resettle in the Bay Area. I think that Oakland also needs to develop an effective witness protection program. So when I began this study, you know, I have the benefit of being at Berkeley Law and having access to some of the most well-known experts on criminal law in the country. And when I asked about the issue of unsolved murders, many would respond to me, well, the problem is that family members and the communities aren't cooperating with the police. I think we need to think more deeply about why family members and communities don't feel like it's safe to cooperate with the police. One father described to me having his son was killed and his daughter cooperated in a criminal investigation and had expressed a lot of fear for her safety. And she was provided with about, you know, a few $100 to live at a hotel for a few days. And that was the extent of the witness protection that she was given. And that is evidently just inadequate.
One thing we haven't really talked much about, Roxana, is the effects on the physical body of the homicide of a loved one, and of course the fact that the investigation being carried out in relation to that murder isn't being pursued vigorously in the perception of the family members. What physical problems or disorders can family members experience, and also what happens or what can happen to the employment status, the job status of family members?
I think those are two really important issues that you raise. You know, I didn't ask for deep backgrounds on physical consequences of the homicide. Family members, three of the family members did experience such severe mental health crisis that they sought inpatient care. Other family members described diabetes, depression, high blood pressure. So there is indications from the interviews that there is a physical consequence of the murder. One study has indicated that 27% of family members of homicide victims are either fired or are unable to work within 2 years of the homicide. And many of the family members that I interviewed were unable to return work, have been unable to return to work. There's a section of the report that draws on a human rights concept called life plan. The idea is that we all have personal aspirations and goals, and human rights violations can interfere with our ability to pursue those goals. One mother described, you know, having moved from Mississippi with the goal of giving her children a better life here in California and helping her family who lived in poverty in Mississippi. And after the homicide of her sons, it happened almost 20 years ago, has not been able to recover. Another father who was a social worker when his eldest son was killed told me that, you know, and had been a social worker for children for years, had to leave that profession. He could no longer do it after his son was killed and continues to do social work, but no longer with children. Homicides have profound psychological consequences, emotional consequences, financial consequences, and also consequences for life aspirations, professional consequences, and employment.
And many of these consequences, as you're saying, are long-term, which reinforces your demand, your insistence that assistance to these victims, to these family members, ought to be over the long term.
Absolutely. We need to contend with the consequences of violence. And while the family members did speak about punishment, they also called for investment in their well-being, in their community's well-being, and highlighted and underscored the importance of a system that addresses their needs and their priorities.
Roxana, you met recently with the Oakland Police Department. What was the purpose of that meeting?
So because there's been press coverage of this report, Oakland Police Department has responded to the report, and I was invited to a meeting between Oakland Police Department and family members. I want to respect the confidentiality of that meeting. What I can say is that the Oakland Police Department has rejected the findings of the report and instead emphasize recent declines in rates of violence in Oakland. The report doesn't take away in any way, or doesn't intend to take away in any way, the success of the ceasefire program and decline in rates of violence in Oakland. But the report does want to highlight that that violence has a legacy, and it has a legacy in these unsolved murders, and the city must take action to address that situation.
I'm going to guess that this kind of response from the OPD will not keep family members and you from advocacy work, from trying to push through measures in other fora to grant relief and comfort to these family members.
No, being a human rights lawyer, one learns to be tenacious really quickly. And I have the privilege and the honor of also being a professor. And so I train our future attorneys by having law students work with me on projects. And I had a team of students working on this project. I had a teaching fellow, Katrina Natale, working with me on this project. And I think it's very important in the Human Rights Clinic for our students to learn that human rights abuses are not just something that happens abroad. We have a commitment to our community to address the human rights violations and abuses that are occurring here at home. And so we endeavor to live up to that commitment. And I hope that I can continue to partner with organizations and family members to bring attention to these issues. And I'm really grateful for this radio program and the opportunity you've given me to talk about the issues that the report examines.
Well, it's a very important and revealing and penetrating report authored by my guest, Roxana Althols, A-L-T-H-O-L-Z. She's co-director of the International Human Rights Law Clinic at Berkeley Law, which issued the report. She's also an international human rights scholar and a clinical professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law. Roxana, thanks so much for your investigative work, for putting this report together, and for joining us today.
Thank you for this opportunity.
And that interview first aired on March 17th of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.